Welcome to Android Developers Backstage, episode number 1, 2, 3. I am Chet Haas from the Android Framework team.
I'm Tor Norby from the Tools team.
And today we have...
I'm Adrian Ludwig from the Android Security team.
And we thought it would be fun to talk to Adrian about all things security, which I figured would actually be kind of a tenuous conversation, like what can we and can't we ask? And actually, there's no bars held until we find out that that's not correct. But in the meantime, it'd be nice to find out what the state of Android security is. So let's do that. But maybe a little bit of background, like where do you come from? Why are you working on security now? What have you been doing on the team?
Where do I come from?
Where were you born? You know, that kind of stuff.
Start at the very beginning.
Yeah.
My mom and my dad.
Yeah. Well, there's.
So I've been in security for quite a while, actually. I'd like to harken back, if you will, to high school. I had a really random interaction. I walked into my high school guidance counselor's office, and they said, hey, do you want to be a spy? And it turned out there are government programs that will pay for you to go to college, which worked out pretty well for me. So I ended up having my my education in security starting right then and there, basically. I had... government organization pay for me to go to school and learn a lot about math and crypto, and I ended up spending a number of years there. And then I've sort of meandered my way through industry over about the last 15 years.
I have to ask at this point, when people talk about NSA tapping into tech companies like, you know, Google and whatever, who are you working for right now?
He's a pilot. I work for Google, and I work for the users of Android more than anything. And I think that's actually an interesting point, that Android is really about Android users. It's fascinating when we think about the security model for Android, who it is that is a potential threat and who it is that we're concerned about, right? We are concerned about the obvious attackers, people who write malware, people who are in, trying to take advantage of users that are criminals. We think a lot about governments and the possibilities that they might try to manipulate those devices, attack those devices. We try to design them to protect against them. We think about people who are, you know, generally good application writers, and they think of themselves being operating in the best interest of their users, but, you know, sometimes they go a little bit far. And so we have things like permissions to make sure that users are aware of what's going on in the system so they can kind of provide an audit. I think that's one of the things that's really, really interesting about Android is how much we focused on openness, and not just open source, but really on understanding how the ecosystem works, who all the players are, and removing some of the sort of secrecy that's always been around security. So that's one of my goals, is anything that's sort of a sacred cow, where classic security answers, I can't tell you about that, or that's a secret and we keep it a secret in order to protect people, pretty much we're open about it as much as we possibly can. So we consider NSA, the CIA, the Mossad, all of the, and I'm sure there are many of them, Chinese intelligence organizations, all of those are potential attackers depending on who you are. And so we take that very seriously.
So, malware.
Sure.
So something hits the store that is doing things that we don't approve of. What's the process of finding out about that thing, getting rid of it, making sure the users are protected? What's all the ecosystem that surrounds potentially harmful applications?
Yeah, I like the fact that you use potentially harmful applications, because I hate the phrase malware. Even within Google, we use the word malware, and it drives me bonkers, because I don't know what it means. Mal has this Latin root.
He's also the captain in Serenity.
That's true. Yeah. Was it? I'm trying to think of the other actors that were in there. I can only think of the one girl. But who's on Homeland now?
I missed him there.
No, her.
Her. I missed her there,
too. You didn't miss her.
Yeah.
What's that?
Morena Baccarin.
Yes, you're right. Morena. Homeland's a good show, too, if you want to think about the espionage angle.
Okay.
So malware has this confusing aspect to it, right? It could be things that are bad. It could be things that are malicious, depending upon what the Latin root is that you want to pull from. But what we focus on in the security team are the things that we consider to be potentially harmful applications. So things that could hurt your device, hurt other applications on the device, hurt you directly in the way that they disclose information about you.
Do you have a sense of whether that's, most of those apps, are they accidentally harmful because of developer mistakes, or are they intentional attempts to do something harmful.
Yeah, so this is where I want to be careful with the word malicious, right? Because I think people assume that there's an effort to be harmful. And I think a lot of times there's not that effort. The other thing I would say is the vast majority of things that get removed from Google Play, I don't think of them as being harmful in any way, right? There's a lot of rules about what kinds of applications can be inside of Google Play, things like copyright, right? We don't want those inside of Google Play for obvious reasons, illegal to distribute them. Do the users who install those necessarily think that they were harmful? No, definitely not. Would they classify them as malware? No, not malicious. But they are things that we would suspend. And the vast majority of the things that get taken down from Google Play are in that category of content that somebody wanted when they installed it, but that just isn't appropriate for that market. And so we spend a lot of time removing that kind of content. The things that we see that are potentially harmful, the ones where, whether it's intentional or not, we think that there's a real likelihood that the user would be hurt or that another application would be hurt, are extraordinarily rare. We scan every application that goes up to Google Play. We look for a lot of different types of things, everything from sending of premium SMS without sending a notification to the user to downloading what I think of as excessive personal information, right? Copying off all the contacts on your address book without telling the user to do it. And that's where there's a lot of nuance to whether something is potentially harmful or whether something is intended, right? If the application advertises itself as a backup solution for your contacts or as a social network, then there is some element of interpretation that goes into it.
I'd say most social networks advertise, publicize too much personal information. That's what they do.
That's what makes them social, I guess, right? Which is maybe what makes me not so social. But yeah, I mean, there certainly have been instances of applications taking that information without permission, where we have then potentially suspended the application in Google Play, reached out to the developer, had a conversation with them, they've made changes, and then the application has come back. And the reason is they were confused about it, they didn't understand what was necessary. In some instances, it was just a mistake. As someone who produces software for a living, bugs happen. And sometimes things that were supposed to be in testing only, or a consent screen was removed because it couldn't be translated. There's lots of reasons that those kinds of things would happen. And so we try to be very open and have a conversation with developers about what the potential problem was and any potential correction that they could make. So those are some of the things that we're doing, is trying to help the developers avoid making mistakes, right? Because they're just trying to help their users for the most part, is what we find.
Are there some favorite mistakes you know about that developers make when they write their apps that sort of exposes, the user's information or even leaves, backdoors into the system?
Let's see. I mean, there are lots of best practices that don't get followed. I think one of the less well understood and less well utilized capabilities of the system is using of intents and requesting capabilities from other applications. So, for example, using the contacts chooser. You can issue an intent that says, give me a contact, it popped up a chooser, and the user can select which contact should be connected to a particular application. That doesn't require any permissions. Whereas most applications request the contacts permission, and then they go through and iterate through the entire database of contacts. And so that's an example of something that's not harmful, it's not malicious. It does make applications look suspicious because users don't necessarily understand what the contacts are going to be used for. And it does mean that the applications themselves are more likely to make a mistake because they have to iterate through the entire contacts database. And so if there is a vulnerability in that application, then access to contacts is sensitive. So that's an example of something where, anytime you want to perform an action that can be provided through an intent rather than directly through an API, we would encourage people to take a look at that and see one way to do it. And the context chooser is a good example of that.
What about permissions in general? So we had a conversation with Jeff Sharkey last week about the mm-hmm. storage access framework. And one of the interesting things that I thought was in there was in the area of permissions, where it's taking file saving and reading permissions to a different, more granular level, where instead of requesting access to the SD card or some file storage mechanism there, and the user has to grant it just to install the application, instead, every time you access a file, you basically go through the user. You say, mm-hmm. We would like to open this file, and the user has to grant the permission. It's granular to the level of, like, it reminds me a little bit of the horrible Vista thing where everything you did on the operating system popped up this little translucent dialogue saying, something horrible is about to happen, is this okay? Except it's really useful in this context because obviously the user wants you to open that file or not.
Well, it's not asking for permission, it's saying it's asking you to pick the file. So it's like, yeah, file
right.
chooser,
yeah.
which
so
doesn't have the same technological.
Embedded with the same action
yeah.
is the permission that the user is voluntarily granting the application access to this file, which I thought was a really good move away from the like blanket permissions to do a bunch of stuff mm-hmm. with files that you don't know about versus the you need access at this particular time to this particular resource.
Yeah, I mean, this is the struggle, right? The struggle is to have the user have a sense of control and feel comfortable with what's going on, but not inundate them with questions. And I think that's the age-old security struggle. And I had a bunch of conversations around permissions and is the way that they're presented proper or there are other models that we should be looking at. And my personal view is basically any time that you are asked an explicit security question, we, meaning the Android team, have failed. Because there has to be some way that we could know enough to help you make that decision, right? To bias the question, to bias the answer for you, to make it more consistent with what you actually expect. And I think a lot of times we hard code questions into the platform, and this is not true just of Android, this is true in general of operating systems and platforms. We hard code questions because we don't want to have to do the hard work to figure out the answer.
But isn't it also the case that, you know, so for example, when you install an app and it tells you that it needs C7 permissions mm-hmm. and it explains what each permission is, I've heard that some developers would like to explain why, mm-hmm. but that I've heard that that's also a bad idea because they could then trick you. They could come up with a plausible sounding excuse that makes it sound like it's legitimate, whereas really you need to realize that this app could be lying to you. And that's something that, you know, so I don't know if you have.
Yeah. I mean, the user experience around those kinds of things is hard. I think part of the question of whether a bias like that, you know, whether allowing the developer to present more information is a good thing or a bad thing, depends upon some statistics. If 99% of your apps, which actually is a low order estimate for Android, are from well-intentioned application developers, then providing them the ability to communicate to their users is 99%+ of the time going to be a good thing, right? It increases conversation, it is reliable information. But I think a lot of security practitioners build their systems worrying a ton about that 0.1%, perhaps way too much about that 0.1%. And so I think when we're looking at Android right now, I would argue the more communication there can be from the developer to the user, the better off we're going to be. And there's a variety of reasons for that. One is just increases trust. The other is, you know, well-intentioned developers that do a good job of explaining what they're doing are ones that you should trust. And the last is, and this is kind of a controversial position, is it's rope. If a developer tells you they're going to do something and then they don't, they've lied to you. And that becomes very, very clear when you're interpreting what the intentions are and whether it's appropriate for that to be distributed, say, through Google Play, right? If they've told you we're not going to do X or Y, and it's clear that they did it, there's no ambiguity about whether it's right or not. Whereas right now, I think a lot of data manipulation and data usage, it's sort of ambiguous, right?
Right, so they ask for some permission. Mm-hmm. And right now, we can't, and it can't very easily tell if what they're doing with that permission is legit or not. But mm-hmm. if they're saying, look, we only need your contact information because you want to do this one thing, and then we can programmatically see that they're doing something else, that would be sort of a better way.
It makes it much more clear right. when they're doing something that the user hasn't signed off on.
Right.
Yeah, and I actually, you know, Android is interesting compared to previous platforms because this is the first one where you could tell this application is asking for my contacts. You can't tell that on other platforms. Like now we rewrite history and we assume other platforms had that capability previously. When Android did it, it was the first to do it. And you couldn't tell whether an application was accessing data from another app or from another, you know, data provider or whatever. And so I think, yeah, there's a natural continuation to make the developer be more explicit about how they're going to use the information. So that's something that we're spending time thinking about, trying to figure out how to do that to improve the quality of the information that users have.
How about the permissions, the sort of the granular versus coarse, which mm-hmm. is also an ongoing debate ever since I've been in this
granular
sector.
Versus coarse, optional versus not optional, runtime versus install time.
Right.
These are all of the sort of questions, right?
Yeah, or what happens if, you know, yeah, I want this application installed, but I don't want you to have that permission, which is a really hard problem to solve.
Yep.
Maybe the application is written sort of around that capability, so how yep. do you disable that?
I mean, we're really committed to not making life harder for anyone, which is a tough spot to be in, right? We don't want to make it really hard for developers to build applications that work reliably. So things like optional permissions make that more challenging, right? Things like the user being able to turn something on and off that potentially affects the behavior of the application, also potentially affects the revenue model for an application. That's a hard problem. At the same time, having a user have to know how to find a particular feature buried in settings in order to turn off something for an application also is not making life easier for that user. So those are the things that we've been trying to figure out, is how do you make it viable for the developer, understandable for the developer, and also viable and understandable for the user. I don't have a silver bullet, but it's something that we're spending a lot of time thinking about.
Do you have a sense of, when you're looking at these apps getting submitted, do you have a sense of apps asking for more permissions than they need? Because I know that at least early on we saw people just copying, sample code a lot and ending up with stuff in their manifest file asking for permissions they didn't actually need.
Yeah.
And so in the tools we're looking at abilities to identify this and remove them, but it's very tricky because we don't really have good information about exactly which APIs require which permissions. It's not as simple as, hey, this method call requires this. It's sometimes like, hey, if your Apple will ask for this content URI, then, with this sub thing, then you need this permission and so forth.
Yeah, there's some good public research on that particular topic, actually, done out of Berkeley by another Adrian, whom I can never remember if it's Felt Porter or Porter Felt, so I apologize for whichever of the two that I got wrong. But anyway,
I think it's the second. I've talked to her.
I talk to her all the time. I just can't remember.
Well, then this is more embarrassing for you.
I remember her first name, which is my first name. That's pretty good, right? But the research showed that the vast majority, and I don't remember the exact number, but something like 60 to 70% of apps are not doing what they call over-permissioning, right? Requesting a surplus of permissions beyond the ones that they actually exercise. So it's a legitimate concern, right? And it's also an interesting filter because it's not possible to request fewer permissions than you need,
right,
or your app doesn't work, right? So the only possibility is you ask for too many. But that seems to be the minority of applications that ask for too many. So that's the good news. It is interesting, though, if you start looking at applications. The back end for analyzing applications, publicly we've talked about, we call it Bouncer, that has our sort of insight into applications that are in Google Play and elsewhere that we use for looking for malware.
So when people submit apps to the Play Store, it goes through this Bouncer?
Yeah, we have a repository of sort of all of the applications that we've ever seen. So we can run queries against that. And I ran a query the other day on, what are the most popular permissions? It's fascinating. We should publish the data at some point. But yes, so internet is very high.
Deleting your file system, is that one of them?
No. Okay. What's fun, though, is like right around number 20 in terms of popularity, you start getting typos.
Oh boy. Like,
it just doesn't do anything, right? Because if you have a typo in the permission, the system grants it to you, but there's no thing that you get.
Yeah, we need to fix that with tools. Lint, here we go.
That's actually our protection against actually malicious malware, is just, people producing these things are probably just not very intelligent, therefore they're going to not.
But there are some of them that look totally legitimate. There's a GPS-specific permission, which was in some sample code that we produced at some point, which has clearly been copied and pasted a bunch of times. But once you get down below, like, number 17 or 18 or 20, you're down into, like, fewer than 1% of apps. It's a very, very small percentage of applications actually use it, so it's not that embarrassing. The fact that there are, like, I stopped counting at 1,500 different permissions is interesting. So it's a complicated ecosystem, no doubt about it.
What else can you say about how Bouncer works?
How does it work? So our goal, it's very simple. We want to understand everything we possibly can about an application and about where the application came from and about what the application wants to do. So any mechanism that we can think of to glean that kind of information, we're going to try to put it to use. So process-wise, as soon as we know about the author of an application, we start sort of trying to figure out what information is available about that author. Maybe they are registered in Google Play, and then that gives us some information about their history and types of apps they've built in the past and that sort of stuff. That becomes very, very relevant if you see changing behavior. One of the folks.
Is that sort of like on, is it eBay when you're sort of looking at the buyer seller histories? Or sort of like if you're a well known seller, you feel more confident about it than if you are a brand new account?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's true for
Yeah.
That's just true, right? Like, that's how people have evaluated the security of transactions going back 100 years, right? Were you introduced by a friend? Did they, you know, provide some attestation that you're a reliable party for me to interact with? You know, even if I was wearing a sword and chainmail back in the day, that was, you know, that kind of credibility.
Is that information we can surface in the Play Store so that when you're looking at an app, you can get a sense of our trust level of a developer? Or
we surface it a very small amount in terms of how many installs they've had and some other things like that. I think we could do better there. And that's something that we're thinking a lot about. So that's sort of metadata around who's created the application, which is very important for evaluating the application. And it helps color decisions. Mm-hmm. We then, at some point, or it wouldn't be relevant, that person is going to open a Play developer account, potentially, if they're publishing their application to Google Play. So then we have some financial transaction with them because they have to buy something from us. We know at that point, you know, some credit card information, some real world validation of their identity. We can associate that with some other data as well. From there, we wade into sort of the technical aspects of evaluating application if it gets uploaded. So everything from static analysis, like pulling apart all the code, looking for what are the characteristics of the code. We do dynamic analysis, running the application inside of an emulator. Sometimes it's running in a manner that connects to internet services, sometimes maybe not. So there's a lot of different ways that we can instrument that way. We have looked at a lot of applications, and so we've tried to extract feature characteristics that are particularly interesting. The AV industry, I think, has done a lot around building what they call signatures.
Is that antivirus industry?
Yeah, the antivirus industry. And they do sort of signature-based comparisons. We do some of that. We do some heuristics. So does the application behave in a particular way?
Have you seen, I mean, I know that, you know, when people write code for benchmarks, they try to detect when they're running in a benchmark and then doing something special for that. Have you seen people trying to detect if they are in a bouncer environment and trying to be less, not do those bad things at runtime then?
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point we've seen, yes is the short answer. you know, it's funny, I don't mean this to be negative, but like everybody comes up with this like creative, you know, have you seen this? Have you seen this? It's like, yes.
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 Nothing surprises you anymore.
It's pretty hard to surprise me at this point. But yeah, we've seen both well-intentioned, most advertising libraries check to see whether or not they're running inside of an emulator. And the reason is because there are people trying to commit click fraud. And the way they do click fraud is they run the application inside an emulator and then click on things in order to generate revenue.
Programmatically, they're just okay, guys. Yeah.
And that's something that's been going on for as long as there's been internet advertising, right? So that's a good example of why someone would check to see whether they're running inside of an emulator.
Right.
We see that, and I would guess the vast majority of apps probably at this point have that detection in it. The flip side, we've definitely seen people who are trying to avoid us detecting them, like specifically us.
Right.
Sometimes with strings indicating that that's what they're doing. So yeah, we've seen it. We've seen both times.
Possibly harmful application. So one of the models of applications that we probably don't want to help propagate across the world is they grab someone else's APK and they wrap stuff around it, extra permissions to, you know, spam notifications to the user or something, and then submit it as their own application. Is that an easy thing to detect? Like, do we have APK signatures that we can automatically pick up from these sort of spammy cousins?
It seems like that whole YouTube watermarking thing would be relevant here, right? Sort of getting the essence of something, and even if you try to, you know, fool it by putting stuff in the beginning and the end.
Yeah, I don't think anything is easy to detect. Because ultimately, if somebody's trying to avoid detection, there's some mechanism they can use to make it more difficult.
I mean, is that one of the common things that you would look for when you were talking about the different ways that you're trying to vet this application as valid or not?
Yeah, generally what we're looking for is evidence of harm, right? So there are lots of ways that people try to game the system to gain distribution, right? So that's an example, right? Taking an application that is a popular application, you hope that someone is more likely to install it because it looks and feels and behaves like that more popular application, right? So ultimately, the interesting aspect of that is not, from my standpoint, is what is the harm that it's going to try to do? And so we have to think a little bit about, is it doing something in order to get distribution, or is it doing something because it wants to get harm?
Well, it plays into the copyright issues that you brought up as well, right? That is someone else's content, right?
Yeah, and copyright is really, really hard because I don't know whether it's someone else's content or it's actually your content in the other instance is someone else's content.
True.
And so we rely a lot on third parties telling us whether something is a copyright violation, but being able to tell that two things are related is doable. Being able to tell whether something's harmful is doable. Being able to tell who has copyrighted something, that's actually really, really difficult.
But you know, I don't know a lot about this, but I do remember that I think the web spam team, they were dealing with something similar, right? Where you have an original author post an article, and then within minutes you have these copy sites that just take the content, pretend it's theirs. And I think they were looking at who published first and things like that to figure out. And I don't know if we can do the same. But I would think that these people who are copying it would have to read it from us first, right? So we would have a sense of when it was submitted first, unless, because we're not.
Yeah, we don't see as much of the republication.
I would think it may be more common of identity stuff, because I remember that, you know, I think it might have been BlackBerry came out, they had announced they were going to do Messenger, but before it actually shipped, because they had some delays, there were lots of people submitting official BlackBerry apps, and it, you know, and it's hard for us to know if someone uploads something, are you BlackBerry, right? So do we have, I'm guessing in that specific case, maybe they have a verified account or something, but how do you in general, when someone submits, I'm from First National Bank of Foodtown, you know, how do you know that that really is an employee of that, you know, that institution that's supposedly has an official app. Yes. Is there any kind of...
There's usually typos.
In the real one?
Yeah.
We've had, actually, you know, we've had the identity fraud team at a national bank contact us that there was a phishing application, and we looked at it and we're like, actually, it's published by this other part of the company. So that happens, right? Like, it came from a corporate email account, and it is linked currently off of your website. You should go to, you know...
You guys should talk.
Yeah, you guys can. You guys should talk.
Lunch next Tuesday.
So it goes both ways, right? Yeah. I think in the sort of Windows world, you've seen an increase in phishing and those kinds of things, which are designed to exploit those types of relationships. You know, Android is not... you know, completely removed from that. It's something that we spend a lot of time trying to identify those and remove those, or prevent them from ever getting published. The number of times that we've seen things like phishing applications inside of Google Play is extraordinarily small. I don't have the statistics. I have published the statistics, but I don't have them at my fingertips at the moment.
Do you have some off the top of your head statistics for, you know, how common? Because, you know, you get the impression from certain antivirus companies that this, like, a, you know, huge increase in trend of malware on Android. Like, what is your reaction to that? And, you know, what do the stats tell you?
Marketing is really hard. And making a market where one doesn't exist is really hard. But if I were at a company that was seeing new platforms come to market that are now literally the most popular platforms in the world, and they don't have a problem, and all I can do is sell a solution to that problem, I'm going to do everything that I possibly can to convince the world that that problem exists. And I think that's what we're seeing right now, right, is that the antivirus industry is a going on 30-year-old industry that is trying to figure out how to transition from Windows to other platforms, right? Because they need grow. And that's, I think, what we're seeing. And I know that's a really jaded view, and that's coming from somebody who at one point was in marketing. I was in marketing, I'll attest to that. If you search for my name, you can see all kinds of fascinating
marketing,
things.
Actually. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I still think of you as a marketing
It only took you 20 minutes to admit it, so
yeah.
that's good.
That's pretty good. I'll tell you what, stand up in an audience of security people and ask them, how many of you have experience in marketing? And you don't get very many hands raised. But the point being, they're using exactly the same mechanisms that they use on Windows. The difference is the statistics, if you actually dig into them, are radically different. You know, on Windows, the average person has actually seen a piece of malware. On Android, you know, the average company has not seen a piece of malware. And I've been in rooms with a group of CIOs where they were debating, you know, which antivirus solution they should require on all of their phones. And I said, okay, just step back for a second. You've got 1,000 employees, you've got 5,000 employees, you've got 10,000 employees. Have any of you in the room actually seen a piece of malware? Well, see, yeah, I mean, I've read about it. Like, no. Like, you have all these employees. Have you actually had any of you use Effectivite? And the answer in general, in that specific room, was no. It was four different companies, one of which is a big bank, right, like with 100,000 employees. They just haven't seen it, which is consistent with the statistics that we've seen, where, you know, things that are potentially harmful, that are targeted at collecting data or, you know, attacking a user, are on the order of, you know, onesie, twosie, maybe tensies out of a million installs of applications. So extraordinarily small, right? We're talking lightning strike, winning the lotto kinds of numbers, which I didn't do yesterday. I'm very disappointed.
Well, what did you say about lightning?
Neither. That would have been exciting as well.
Oh, one of the interesting things is that I guess the Play Store keeps track of who has installed what apps. So, you know, mm-hmm. if you retroactively discover, hey, this thing was malware, mm-hmm. or harmful, yeah, was actually harmful. You can figure out actually how many people were infected by it.
We have that data, and then starting about a year ago, Google Play started to offer basically an antivirus solution. We call it Verify Apps. It's buried inside of settings. It's turned on by default. If you go to download an app from outside of Google Play, you'll get a little prompt that says, do you want to allow Google to help protect your device? And if you say yes, then it'll just do it in the background. You probably, with about five nines, 99.999%, you'll never see it again. Right? It's just there. And when you go to install applications, we check to see what those applications are. We send a little data to Google. Google does some evaluation of the application and gets back to you.
So if you go to a third-party app store and you install something, let's say that the Play Store has never seen this app. What happens? I mean, does it just say, I don't know, or does it actually share it with Play then, or how does that work?
We may not have seen the app.
Okay.
That doesn't mean we don't have information about the app.
Okay.
So if it's an app that we've never seen, we might know some information about where you're getting it. We might know some information about the developer. We might, in fact, we do run some heuristics on the device to check to see whether it has particular characteristics that are problematic. Hmm. There are some vulnerabilities that we've seen affect Android devices that are vulnerabilities in the way the manifest file is parsed. So we can check those really, really easily because it's just a manifest file. It's very small and compact. So we can look for those kinds of vulnerabilities and we can say with confidence.
And if you can look at the manifest, I guess you can see which permissions it's asking. I guess, raise more concerns than others.
Potentially, yeah. Yeah. But the short of it is we have data from Play about those applications, and then we have data from users going back about a year. I think at this point, last time I checked, it's like 2.5 billion installs outside of Google Play that we have data on. And so if someone says, we see this application and it's being widely distributed, I can actually go back and look and see, well, when you say widely distributed, you mean like 4 people in this country. Because we actually have historical data going back. So it's useful for us to help understand the level of threat associated with particular vulnerabilities, with particular applications. And it's also, I think, going to become increasingly useful for third parties to have some way to evaluate the claims that are being made. So we just started talking about this publicly about 2 or 3 months ago, where we released a bunch of the data in a talk that I gave at a antivirus industry conference called Virus Bulletin. It was in Germany.
How do they search for this talk if they want to hear it?
Probably searching for my name and Virus Bulletin is not a bad way to start.
And your name is Adrian Felt. What was it?
Ludwig.
Okay.
It's Ludwig.
Just spelled Felt Porter.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
She has more data than I do, actually, when it comes out there. But the specific data in terms of breadth of it that we put out, I think, is it's unique, right? I don't see any other platform providers that are doing that. And the way we look at it is different from how the AV industry looks at things. They like to see numbers that are increasing. My favorite number is next year is going to be a record for malware. Yes, I guarantee tomorrow is going to be a record, and the day after that's going to be a record because the numbers always go up, right? They can't go down because they're just counting. And as soon as they find something new, it's a record. It's another record. Right? It's like every day for me is a record. I'm older. Yes, it's just the way counting works. But it produces headlines, so it's good. It's a good marketing tactic.
So it seems like another dimension of the protection against this stuff is the public angle, the user angle, where things are voted on, right? That's an essential part of people installing applications. So I was asking about the copyright things. Somebody took somebody else's APK mm-hmm. and puts it up there. If it's spammy, that generally will get into the reviews mm-hmm. of the application site. Right. So to some extent, we depend on the user space policing itself as well.
So there's policing itself, and then there's producing what I think of as more metadata about the application and how users interact with it, right? So if you go back to the how does Bouncer work, we know some stuff about the developer, and then we know some stuff about the app. And that is all in the context of broader information that we have available about the app ecosystem. Once the application is actually available, we begin to know even more stuff. We know how do users interact with it. Do they install it and then remove it? Do they spend a long time thinking about it before they install it? How are they getting to the application, right? Are they getting it through a hidden referral chain that's 10 deep?
That's the classic way of distributing bad applications through the web browser. Is you have a referrer to a referrer to a referrer to a referrer as a mechanism to, or a redirect to redirect to redirect as a mechanism to sort of cleanse the URL and hide where it's coming from. So there's those kinds of signals that become evident once the application is actually available. And one of the most valuable is direct user feedback, like this thing seems to be spammy or this thing, and that's certainly very, very useful. Unfortunate part is you can't get that data until the app is available. But it's certainly a good secondary check.
And then it's also a mark on the developer as well.
Yeah.
That's more data for future things that developer might do.
And then I would argue like the fifth signal is somebody else who's looking for bad behavior seeing it, right? Mm-hmm. So that would be an AV company or security researcher seeing an application and reporting it to us or to the developer or to somebody else.
So if there are these mega huge platforms which no longer are Windows, and they do not seem to have the same track record for viruses as that platform did.
Yeah.
What are the reasons behind that? Is it that everybody learned a lot more about protecting their systems at the point where this system was built compared to when the fundamentals of Windows were installed? So you have things like permissions that get granted by users and stuff. Like what are the factors that contribute to things not being as rampant as they were or as they still are?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of factors. Certainly there are factors that we can control, right? So as the Android team, having sandboxes as the default sort of paradigm for building your application, incredibly valuable, right? Your data is isolated. You don't have access to data by default. One of the most frequent requests that we get from the security industry is, I need to have root in order to be able to inspect all the stuff that's on the device. Well, no, nobody has root. Google doesn't have root. The OEMs don't have root, right? There's just not that capability because isolation is so important. I would argue that's one of the huge differences between our platform and other platforms.
Can you explain for a second? Because, I mean, I've seen people, especially, a lot of power Android users, they like to get root.
Sure.
Right, because there are certain apps you can run and so forth. But as I understand it, that means you also give up some protection, right? Can you explain that a bit more?
Yeah, it's a complicated question. The way I think about it is when we're building Android, we're designing Android with as much protection as we can put in place. And one of the protections is no application should be able to run as root because that application potentially then is a target. Right. And so we have systematically reduced the set of things that run as root because you want as little privileged code running on the device as possible. So anybody who consciously changes the environment to add more code that's running as root is necessarily sort of increasing the risk. Now, there are lots of people who choose to do that, and certainly it's the case that there are controls that they'll put in place. And I'm not going to argue, good or bad. What I'm going to argue is it increases the attack surface of that device, right? So purely, there is more risk on that device from that sort of standpoint. So that's what our goal is to reduce the amount of code that's running as root because that means there's less code that potentially exposes the user to risk.
So one of my favorite conversations that I had in the last year was I was talking to someone who said, he really likes developing for Android. He does a little app stuff, experiments there. But he doesn't actually own one because obviously viruses are so rampant there. and it's just an inherent thing with the VM that we have. And I sort of didn't even know where to begin the conversation to combat this. So I thought maybe it would be interesting today to talk to a security person to tell me how awful that assumption was.
Yeah,
where is that assumption coming from? Like, where did this reputation come from? Or is it just like the huge platform has that reputation? And then why is that such a not very well thought out position?
Yeah, my favorite variant on that is Android is less secure because it's open source. which I have...
Security through obscurity.
Yeah, I have read that so many times. And I've read it from people that seem credible, like government agencies, who are parroting something that they've read somewhere else, right? So we've definitely seen that.
Do you have specific counterexamples? I mean,
sure.
Have you gotten external people looking at a source going, oh, here's a bug in your code that you probably should fix?
Oh, yeah, we've definitely gotten that. The other thing that we've gotten is people who've said, hey, here's some new functionality that you should add. Not to the biggest example that we've had recently is SE Linux, right? Which was a primarily a government agency, but also some third-party contributors, Samsung and a few of the other OEMs, realizing that having even better isolation between applications was going to be very, very valuable and satisfy some security-critical use cases. And they just started working on it. And that's one of the benefits of being open source. I would argue that the sort of, I don't want to call it free, but the free labor that has been ingested by Android in making itself more secure as a result of being open is incredible. If I go to a security conference and I go to the mobile security track, it's not the mobile security track, it's the Android security track. Because there's nothing to talk about on any of the other platforms. Because you don't know how it works. Like, the best talk that's been given on another platform was a guy, Dino Dezovi, who gave a talk on how security works on iOS. Because just documenting how it works is like the level of research that you need to go to. And so that's the difference, right? Is hundreds of academic researchers, thousands of security practitioners, tens of thousands of developers who are contributing into Android security as a result of it being open source, right? We see every major OEM making contributions. We see all of the major security providers trying to identify where are the potential gaps and fill them. Some of them they fill with their existing business model, antivirus. Some of them they fill with creative new things. Containerization technology is much better than it used to be. Virtualization technology is really, really interesting. There's a lot of really interesting work being done in low-level crypto to enable better trust models for these devices.
Right, so we talked a bit about permissions. What about crypto? What are some things you see, you know, rookie mistakes, you know, people in trying to roll their own, like...
Yeah. We actually have started to see... it's an interesting intersection right now where I think academia understands crypto pretty well, but have never been able to analyze use of crypto. Whereas Android, because it's an open platform and because there's so many applications that are out there, because there's such good security tooling, we're starting to see a surge in academic papers identifying crypto flaws in applications, but they always end up in Android applications because they're not able to look at the other applications, right? So it ends up being labeled as an Android security problem. What it really is cryptography is hard, and Android's the first platform where there's been visibility into how hard it is. And we've seen lots of different things. We've seen people choosing to set their own trust store for SSL socket and choosing to just turn off crypto, right? So they go out of their way to enable OpenSSL, but then they set a default or an empty set of certificates, and so they effectively have not turned on SSL. We've seen recently a paper that came out that talked about improper use of AES, things like using the wrong mode or not applying it properly. So we've seen more and more of that kind of research.
Yeah, I think like picking fixed seeds would kind of would be a problem.
Yeah, ISVs that don't rotate, there's a bunch of... and actually, Tor, you've done some work on... I don't know if we've gotten any of the crypto stuff into Lint.
So there was a blog post a while back that someone on your team posted where we had some issues with initializing the secure element. And so, you know, basically their pseudo-random number generator wasn't actually returning really random numbers at all for certain versions. And so there's this workaround.
That was the secure, not the secure element, the piece of hardware, but the secure framework method. Yeah, or class, I guess.
Yeah. Right. So there's some code that basically didn't do the right thing on certain versions. So there's this workaround code. So, you know, whenever the security team finds bugs like this where there's a simple pattern to look for in the code, you know, I often go and write lint rules to detect it. So this one we added recently. So, you know, if your code is affected by this, and meaning that there are certain constructors, if you try to construct, you know, a particular SSL socket or whatever, it'll then go look for the workaround code. And if you don't have it, it'll tell you, hey, you probably, it looks like you're trying to do something with security, and it looks like you're missing, you know, some workaround code for certain platforms.
And we've started, in addition to the work in Lint, looking inside of the applications that are in Google Play to then notify those developers, which I think is also an example of something that you couldn't do. Like, if someone said, give me the list of every Windows application or Mac application that uses SSL, it's like, no idea, right? Give them even the most popular ones, you're not going to be able to figure it out.
Right, plus I think that, you know, having this app store where apps tend to update also helps because you don't have a lot of people with stale versions out there, right? Yep. So, I mean, that's a big problem, I think, on Windows where people don't update, right? And then you have these apps sitting out there that are known to have vulnerabilities, but, you know, users don't go and update them because, you know, how would they?
Yeah, so what's exciting for me is the ability to sort of help developers do a better job, because they don't want to expose people to risk, right? We don't see that. But they don't know that that's potentially happening.
Right, and crypto code seems like one of those things where it's so easy to make mistakes. You know, especially if you try to do anything outside of, you know, call this library to do it for you. The minute you start like, hey, I'll just store the passwords on my own, and I have this really great idea for an encryption algorithm.
ROT 13.
Yeah.
So
twice.
ROT 26. I like it. I'm gonna do that one. You mentioned SE Linux. There was a change in the level of protection last time on KitKat.
Yes.
And I wondered about. I'm asking the right person. Mm-hmm. The permission level used to be permissive, which I thought was just such an awful term for that permission level. Like that just, you know, like starts the warning bells in my mind. So what did that actually mean, and what was the change?
Yeah. So there are three elements, if you will, that are sort of interchangeable. One is the policy that you have set on a specific domain. Mm-hmm. And SE Linux policies, you prescribe not the things that are forbidden, which is the way that normal policy is written, right, in other domains, but the things that are allowed. Right? By default, you get nothing in SE Linux. And so we have to go through and we say an app, which for Android applications, they run in the untrusted domain, but init runs in its own domain, and all of the system applications run in their own domains. But for a developer looking at this, you run inside of what's called the untrusted app domain. You know, you're allowed to access the file system. You're allowed to access the network. Like, there's a bunch of things that we have to enable so that that can happen. Whereas init, I believe, can't access the network because it doesn't need to. So policy specifies what things are allowed and not allowed. And then the question is, what happens if you perform an action that's not allowed? And in permissive, all that happens is that gets logged. And in enforcing, what happens is you get terminated immediately and with prejudice.
Okay. Then it doesn't do what I thought it did from permissive. Just, yeah, there was a lot of implications there that just didn't seem positive.
Yeah. Yeah. So the goal for us is to have SE Linux sort of fade away silently. And a lot of what the security team does, you know, we're succeeding if people are not thinking about security. And so the way we're rolling it out was roll out a set of policies in permissive, check to see whether or not anything generated audit events, which would indicate that maybe our policy wasn't correct. And then we're slowly at this point transitioning each of the different domains into enforcing. So most of the system applications have very well defined behavior, right? It's code, it's not going to change. Whereas like the untrusted domain has users interacting with it. There's a lot more complexity there. And so that one is coming along a little bit more slowly, coming along a little bit more carefully, where we want to make sure that we're not breaking applications. But the intention is not to ever have SE Linux be visible. We're talking about it just so people are on the lookout for it right now, but a year from now, a year and a half from now, my expectation is people will sort of forget that it's there. It's just part of the Android security model.
So what's the intersection of SE Linux permissions, like file access permission or whatever, and the permissions that we were talking about, the Android, you know, APK permissions that you request? Is that just like applications in general have this ability, but you have to opt into it with the SDK level permission then?
Yeah, so the user interface, if you will, for a developer is permissions. Mm-hmm. and APIs. And underneath those permissions and APIs are sort of all of the scaffolding for the security model. And that's everything from file system permissions to the fact that we use different UIDs. Right? That's not strictly relevant to the application. Like, knowing what your UID is generally is not going to be relevant. SE Linux is part of that. There's a whole bunch of things that we've done beneath the sheets, like adding an ASLR to randomize environment to make exploits more difficult. Removing privileges on system applications, a lot of work that's being done to just minimize the possibility of there being any kind of exploitation on those devices.
I know that for, you know, native app, at least in, you know, the desktop world, native apps seem to have more problems than things written in Java, right? Because, you know, you had a sort of sandbox model. Do you see the same thing on Android? I mean, are you more concerned about apps that sort of use native code, or does it not really matter because it's just basically protected at the process level?
So the model is very different. So the Java model on other operating systems creates a virtual machine and isolates code within that. On Android, whether you're writing in Java or whether you're writing in C and then writing, you know, in Dalvik or eventually writing, running, you know, sort of against ARM or Intel or whatever, doesn't change the security model at all. There's no isolation there. So that aspect doesn't bother me, right? We don't have to worry about there being buffer overflows in the virtual machine right. as a potential risk, right. which I think is where Java in the browser, especially right now, is running into tons and tons of problems, right? It's just really hard to write a robust virtual machine to prevent escapes from the virtual machine. So we didn't even bother trying, mm-hmm. is, you know, the short answer there. It is the case, though, that if you're writing an application that ingests data, most apps do, although some games probably don't, then if you're going to be parsing that data...
mouse event data.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to write malform, you know, to cause malform mouse event data.
You need special hardware.
In a movie, you could probably do it, right? The guy that can crack 128-bit AES key while he's sitting at a table. It's the same guy that can...
That's how you blow up the spaceship. Have you seen the documentary? What was it called? Independence Day?
Yeah. It was very good. But native code is more prone to vulnerabilities. You know, through, in particular, the way it handles strings and the way it manipulates pointers makes it more likely to have vulnerabilities in it. So it's definitely better practice from a security standpoint to write your code in a bytecode language, Java, for example.
I know that the Chrome team pays out these rewards. Mm-hmm. You know, if people find bugs in the, you know, basically if they can create exploits. Yeah. Do we have anything similar for Android, or do we have plans to, or, you know?
Yeah, so Android's model is a little bit different from Chrome's, in part because there are so many different devices that are out there. And so the model of a, you know, tell us about a vulnerability and then you get money, didn't make a ton of sense for us. We thought about it, thought a lot of, comes up regularly, but it didn't really make a lot of sense. About a month and a half ago, maybe 2 months ago at this point, the Google security team launched something that they called the Patch Rewards Program, where it was not about, you know, if you find a bug, let us know. It was about if you make a contribution to an open source project, let us know. If it improves the security, we'll pay for you. You know, we'll give you some bonus for that. So we looked at that and we thought that actually is a model that would work really well, right? Developers making contributions, whether it's fixing a vulnerability or adding a CTS test for a known vulnerability or adding in policy for SE Linux, or, you know, there's infinite number of ways that you can improve the security as opposed to just poking holes at the security. And so we are now participating in the Patch Rewards Program, and we've started to get in patches. In some instances, those patches just show up in AOSP, and that's great. If there's sensitivity, you know, maybe it's not appropriate to publish it directly into AOSP because it's a vulnerability or something, they can just email us at security@android.com and we'll sort of talk them through what the process looks like to get those patches in there. But yeah, I don't know if we've actually paid out a reward yet, but I know that we have accepted some submissions and we will eventually be paying some out in short order.
That's great.
I'm tapped out for questions.
No more security questions.
Are there any, what is the most common question you get when you do talks on security at Google I/O or elsewhere?
Wow. The malware one comes up a lot. Update one comes up a lot.
What's that? The
why does my device not get updated?
Oh, yeah.
Which, I mean, it's actually an interesting question from a security standpoint. And the answer is it's getting better. You know, with KitKat, I think we saw some devices updated almost as fast as the Nexus devices, which is pretty exciting for those of us that really want to see updates happen quickly. And I think all the major manufacturers at this point have taken it to heart that it's in the best interest of their users to make sure that they're getting updates as quickly as possible. So that's been good progress.
Well, do you have anything else you want to tell our listeners?
Thank you guys very much. Appreciate getting a chance to talk with you.
That's great. Thanks. Thank you.
Bye. Yeah. And that's it.
We're all done.